everyone. This is Perry Crosser. So today, I want to talk about upcoming job interview next week, how I did the investigation for this company, this industry, and this position for this interview preparation. Here, I want to share what I got and also the process I did this investigation. So this is for senior leadership role at a massive multi-billion dollar company. And it's an industry where I have to be process zero direct hands-on experience. Now, if my rather extensive personal history of job interviews has taught me anything, it's that a cross-industry job like this, what you'd call a long shot, and puts the odds at about 90% chance of failure. A polite, soul-crushing email that started with the classic line, "Well, your background is very impressive. We decided to move forward with a candidate whose experience is more aligned with our industry." Something like that. We've all been there, right? Knowing this, knowing that failure is the most likely outcome, I did the only logical things a perfectly sane people would do. I spent a couple of hours falling into a deep, obsessive rabbit hole, compiling the equivalent of a private investigator's dossier on this company. I've read through their financials, analyzed their competitors, deconstructed their business model, and even done a bit of LinkedIn stalking on the person who held this job before. Why? It's a fair question. It's partly because on that slim 10% chance I actually get this job, I will be incredibly prepared. But mostly, it's for the 90% chance I get blown out of the water. Because in that scenario, all of this work, all of this research can't go to waste. It has to become something, right? And that something is this podcast episode. We're not going to let good research die on the hill of the failed interview. So today, we are going to salvage my doomed to fail interview preparation. We are going to perform a full corporate autopsy on a company I might soon be working for, or more likely, a company that will soon be politely rejecting me again. All right, everyone, welcome to the show. So, let's get into it. First, you may ask, what is this company? All right, this company, the name is GLP. Not GLP-1. Hey, maybe in the future, I may make another episode to talk about medical industry. Talk about, let's say, Eli Lilly, diabetic. Then we may talk about GLP-1, a key component of medicine for obesity. Okay, today's GLP is for global logistic properties. On the surface, their business seems almost comically simple. They build and manage massive warehouses, the kinds of big greases you see off the highway. But here is the thing. This isn't just a construction company. The document I have here says they are an investment manager with about $80 billion in assets under management. So the big question is, how do you get from building shares to being a global investment giant? The answer, I think, is the business model that the financial world calls a flywheel. It is a three-step process they call develop, operate, fund. And honestly, it is a masterclass in financial engineering. Let's break it down. Because this is the engine that powers the entire kingdom. First up is develop. This is the obvious part. They build the shares. But there aren't just any shades. They are masters of this game. They acquire huge plots of land in the most strategic location you can imagine, right next to the major ports, airport, and city hubs. And they build what the industry called high-spec facilities. We're talking warehouses with 10 meters ceilings, hyperflat floors so that armies of robots can glide across them, hundreds of trucks bay, all that complex, high-end infrastructure that massive global companies like BMW, Adidas, and Jingdong need to run their supply chains. So this is the builder phase. They have the expertise to build these industrial castles on time and on budget. Okay, so the shiny new warehouse is built. That brings us to step two, operate. This is where they become the landlord. Their job is to get the building fully leased out, manage the property, keep the tenants happy, and make sure those rent checks clear every month. This sounds like the boring part, right? But it is absolutely critical. This is the phase that turns a pile of concrete and steel from a development project into what finance people call a stabilized income-generating asset. The steady, predictable cash flow from rent is the entire point. So they have to prove that the castle they built isn't just pretty. It's a profitable business. Now, this is where most realistic companies would stop. They build something, they rent it out, and they collect rent checks for the next 30 years. It is a good, solid business, isn't it? But GLP has a third step. And this is the magic trick. I have to say that I never imagined that before. Step three is fund. This is the brilliant part. Once a warehouse is mature, means it is fully leased out and generating that sweet, stable cash flow, GLP doesn't just sit on it. They monetize it. They package these profitable warehouses into investment funds, like a public REIT, REIT, which is for Realistic Investment Trust, or private funds for big institutions like pension funds and insurance companies. They then sell these funds to investors, cashing out immediately. This is the key. They are recycling their capital at an incredible speed. They build an asset, prove it profitable, sell it to investor, and get a huge pile of cash back right now. And what do they do with that cash? They go and start a whole process over again, building even more warehouses. And the best part? They still get to collect management fees for operating the asset they just sold. It is a beautiful and brutally effective money machine, isn't it? Now, I have to be honest. When I first understand this model, one part of my brain said, genius. But another part screamed, danger. This kind of capital recycling, this asset securitization, it feels a bit like trying to fly by pulling up on your own bootstraps. In Chinese, we'd say it's like trying to lift off by stepping on your own feet. It relies heavily, and I mean heavily, on a healthy market that is always waiting to buy your assets. If the economy slows down, if interest rates go up, and if investors suddenly get nervous and stop buying, the entire flywheel can grind to a halt. If you're carrying a lot of debt, and your primary way of paying that debt is by selling assets, well, We are all seeing stories like Evergrande. Hengda is the Chinese name. Companies that playing the capital games so hard, they played themselves into a corner. It is a brilliant model, but it's a high-wired act. And as we will see, that wire is starting to wobble. But I have to say that the high-wire act has a fascinating history. This company that is so centered to China economy actually started in America. Its predecessor was a U.S. company founded way back in 1991 called Security Capital Industrial Trust. For a while, it was a successful American business. But the pivotal moment, the event that changed everything, happened in 2003. In 2003, GLP made a huge bet. They entered China, setting up an office in Shanghai. And about 2 years later, I came to Shanghai as well. Now, you have to picture what China was like back then. It was just joining the WTO, World Trade Organization, and its manufacturing economy was about to explode. But there was a huge problem. They had almost no modern warehouses. They had factories, they had ports, but the infrastructure to store and move all those goods efficiently just wasn't there. GLP basically introduced the very concept of modern logistics real estate to the country. And their timing was perfect. They got in on the ground floor of the biggest economy boom in human history. The result? Explosive growth. At that time, they completely dominated the market. At one point, my research shows their market share in China was bigger than the second place competitor all the way to the 10th place competitor combined. They became an undisputed giant. And this period is what my research memo calls the forging of company's China DNA. Okay, so they've conquered China. What's next? Global expansion, no wonder. And to do that, you need cash. A lot of it. This leads to the second major turning point. In 2010, GLP listed itself on the Singapore Stock Exchange in what it was. At the time, the biggest real estate IPO in the world. This move flooded the company with capital. This is the moment GLP evolves. They are no longer just builders and landlords. They are now sophisticated financial engineers. And that brings us to the most dramatic moment in the company history. 2018. If you remember one thing about this company, it should be this event. A consortium of Chinese investors. We are talking heavy hitters like Hillhouse Capital and Wanke launches a takeover bid. They end up buying the entire company and taking it private in a deal worth around $12 billion. At the time, it was the largest private equity buyout of a listed company in Asia history. Let's be very clear about what this means. This wasn't just a financial transaction. It fundamentally changed the company's identity. It went from being a company founded in the US and listed in Singapore to being an entire controlled by Chinese capital. My research document puts it perfectly. This privatization established the company's essence as a Chinese company. Even though it operates in 17 countries, its strategic heart, its center of gravity, and its ultimate decision-making power now resides in China. This history brings us directly to today. After years of growth, the global company changed. In late 2023, the rating agency Standard & Poor's downgraded GLP's credit to junk standards, citing that they were having trouble selling their assets quickly enough to manage their debt. And that leads directly to the blockbuster news from 2024. GLP sold a massive chunk of its international business in Japan, Europe, and the US to a competitor named Ares. This wasn't a minor portfolio adjustment. That was a strategic retreat. It was a move to raise cash, stabilize the balance sheet, and refocus the company's resources on its core defendable market, China and the rest of Asia. So, GLP is giant, but as we've established, it's a giant under pressure, and it's not alone in this jungle. To truly understand the challenge, we have to look at its rivals. What we are seeing in this space is a full-blown, high-stake, and technology arm race. Let's do a deep dive on the two main global competitors. First, ladies and gentlemen, you have the undisputed 300 kilo gorilla in the room, Prologis. Well, if this were Star Wars, Prologis would be the Galactic Empire. They are staggeringly huge, with over $200 billion in assets under management, more than double GLP's size. They are everywhere, with a dominant presence in North America and Europe. But what makes them terrifying isn't just their size. It's their brain. For years, they have been systematically embedding technology into their DNA. They have their own corporate venture capital arm, Prologis Ventures, which acts as their external radar. They've invested in over 50 tech startups, companies specializing in software, robotics, and data analytics. They don't have to invest everything themselves. They use their massive checkbook to buy or partner with the smartest little companies over there. Second, and this is the really scary part, they are fanatics about what they call AI democratization. Instead of having a small, elite priesthood of data scientists, they want to make everyone a data warrior. They've adopted a company-wide platform called Data IQ and have to put AI tools into the hands of over 2,000 of their regular employees, who has now built over 60 active AI projects to solve their own daily problems. Think about how powerful that is. It's like they're not just training a few elite Jedi Knights. They are giving every single soldier in this army a lightsaber. The skill is just different. Okay, now, let's look at the second competitor, Goodman Group. If Prologis is the massive, methodical empire, Goodman is more like a religious zealot who has seen the future and is betting everything on a single prophecy. Their assets are similar to GRP's, around $84 billion. But their strategy is one of radical surgical focus. I call them the prophet, because Goodman has looked at the world and made one. Gigantic, all or nothing bet, data centers. They believe the most valuable real estate of future isn't for storing boxes, it's for storing bytes. My research notes they've secured a power capacity of 5 gigawatts for their data center projects. A single gigawatt can power hundreds of thousands of homes. 5 gigawatts is enough to power a small country. They are betting the entire farm on owning the physical layer of the digital world. And that brings us back to our protagonist, GLP. If Prologis is the software empire and Goodman is the hardware prophet. GRP is the awakening giant. They are the king of their home turf in Asia. But when you compare their tech strategy, you see cracks. My research says their digital efforts feel project-driven rather than systematic. They've built some impressive systems, like a data center management platform called GRP DCBase. But it feels like they have skilled blacksmiths forging beautiful custom swords, while Prologis has built a fully automated sword factory. The dossier concludes that GLP seems to be lacking a clear, unified technology vision and platform strategy that span the entire group. And I think that single sentence is probably the reason the job I'm interviewing for exists. So GLP is standing at a crossroads with howling headwinds and massive opportunities. Let's talk about the challenge first, the red flags. So first and most importantly is the intense ROI pressure cooker. This is not a company in a peaceful experimental phase. They just sold their family silver to pay the bills. And a new project, especially a costly data department, will be under a microscope. My research memo put it bluntly. The honeymoon period for this role will be incredibly short. This is a wartime footing, not peacetime. You need to deliver results and deliver them fast. The second major challenge is the culture clash. GLP is, at its core, a 30-year-old real estate company. Its success was built on gut feelings and handshake deals. You've tried to inject a data-driven, tech-first culture into that body. It's a classic organ transplant problem. The organization's muscle memory is to make decisions the way it has always made them. My dossier suggests their data-driven vision is still more of a strategic ambition than an organizational reality. But this is a crossroad, not a dead end. Let's talk about the opportunities. First, there's untapped goldmine of operational efficiency. This is the low-hanging fruit. But for a company this size, the low-hanging fruit are the size of watermelons. The research I have contains a huge metric of possibilities. Imagine using IoT sensors for predictive maintenance on their facilities, or fixing a roof leak 3 months before it happens. Imagine using AI to optimize energy consumption across a logistics park, shaving just 1% off a colossal energy bill. This may be the quick, measurable wins that deliver immediate ROI. But the real price, the holy grail, is in strategic value creation. This is where the data team evolved from a cost center to a strategic weapon. And this connects directly to their big bet on data centers. This isn't just a random bet. I was looking at a recent report on the future of AI impact, and the numbers are staggering. The report I read suggests that by 2030, AI data centers could consume more than 2% of the entire world electricity. The biggest AI training models will require gigawatts of power, almost as much as a large city. So, when GLP pivots to data centers, they are not just building the real estate. They are building the power stations for the next industrial revolution. This is a part of their strategy that points to a massive potential future. My research metrics shows the potential here. Using data for smart set selection for new projects, dynamic pricing model for leases, or even creating entirely new data-driven investment products for their clients. that's how you change the game, right? So, given this reality, what is the real mission of the head of big data? The job description is just a corroborate buzzwords. The real job title probably is Chief Transformation Agent for a Legacy Giant Under Siege. The mission is to build a new weapon, a new capability, from the ground up. The JD breaks the mission down into three core duties. First, data capability building. In plain English, you are the master plumber. GLP's data is a mess scattered in data silos. Mission one is to build the kingdom of central nervous system. Second, data application promotion. Once the plumbing is in place, you act as an internal consultant. You work with the powerful real estate and fund management businesses, helping them answer their hardest questions with data. This is how you deliver quick wins and build trust. Third, AI application construction. This is the end game. You evolve from a plumber to a consultant into product owner and weapon maker. This is about building the future, creating new AI-powered products for their data center and supply chain businesses that can generate their own revenue. So the job has dual personality. You must be a trusted diplomat to the old guard and a visionary revolutionary building the future. So, this is it. We've gone through the whole story. The final question is, what about me? How do I fit into this picture? It's time to create a game plan for the interview. And to do that, we have talked about the ghost in the room, the person who had this job before me, Jenny Yao. I got this name from the headhunt. Understanding her profile is the key to my entire interview strategy. Who is she? My research shows her background is what you would call a business data officer. Her entire career at big companies like eBay and Lufax, which is a part of Ping An, was about using data to help the business. Her profile talks about CRM, customized relationship management, KYC, know your customer, and financial control. She's very good at connecting data to traditional business needs. We have to give her huge respect for that. She wore the first Sage Rocket. She likely did the incredible difficult job of getting a traditional company from zero to one with data. But this is also create a challenge. It creates an anchor effect. The interviewer's idea of great data leader is now anchored to Jenny's profile. They will likely be looking for next Jenny Yao. And my entire interview strategy is to respectfully convince them that they do not need another Jenny Yao. They need something different for the next chapter. The company's mission has evolved. They do not just need the first stage rocket anymore. They need the second stage rocket to get them into orbit. And this is where I tell my story. When they ask about my background, I will show them the contrast. I will say Jenny's experience is incredibly valuable. She connected data to the business. My experience, from my early days as an IT architect at AIA to lead major programs at PayPal, has been about architecting and building the industrial strength platforms themselves. The difference is simple. She answers the business question. I build the engine that can answer a million business questions automatically in milliseconds. The best example I have is from PayPal. I will tell them, at PayPal, my team and I didn't just analyze the fraud data. We built a real-time machine learning system that could access data with less than 1 millisecond of latency. We built a patent fraud detection engine using advanced modeling that automatically found and stopped fraud, saving the company $23 million a year. These are not reports. These are technology products. They are weapons, and building this kind of weapons is the second stage rocket capability that GRP needs. I can also predict their questions. My dossier notes Jennings managed a team over 100 people at Lufax. They might ask about my team size. My answer has to be about leverage, not headcount. My philosophy is to lead a smarter, elite, full-stack team that builds powerful platforms. We use technology and smart architecture to create huge leverage, so a smart team can have a giant impact. And I'd also make it clear that I'm not some revolutionary who will come in and throw everything away on day one. A team of over 30 people is already there, doing their work. My first job would be to stabilize things. You have to understand the current situation, listen to the team, and figure out what's working and what's not. In the first 30 days, it's all about listening. In the next 30, it's about forming a hypothesis and identifying those low-hanging fruit. And by day 90, we should be launching our first small pilot project to build momentum. It's about being a practical builder, not just a visionary. So that's the game plan. I will walk into that interview respecting the past, but positioning myself as a necessary evolution for the future. I'm not the next Jenny. I am what comes after Jenny. Will it work? Who knows? As I said at the very beginning, it's a long shot. They might decide they just want a leader who is more familiar with the logistics industry, or someone who is more like the leader that they had before. And that's okay. But I feel prepared. I've done the autopsy, and I feel like I stand the company's heart and soul now. I know its strengths, its fears, and I know the value I can bring to them at this exact moment in their history. Whatever happens, this exercise, it wasn't a waste. It was a hell of a lot of fun. Okay. Thank you everyone for listening my research report and being a company with me. Please wish me luck, and I will share the interview result in the future to see whether it works. Thank you everyone, have a good day, and see you next time.